had a good discussion at tea time yesterday about meditation. So I thought I might talk about that a little bit. So today is 11th of May, 2021. Bhayagiri Monastery, there's now a few comings and goings happening, and Tanchit Apollo has gone to the East Coast to visit family, and a new monk, we'll have a new monk or a new member of our communities, Tankema, will be here the 27th. We've had a lot of comings and goings over the years, so that's also coming up, in addition to thinking about meditation. There's a lot of different methods of meditation in different traditions, and it's good to remember what we want to do. We want the mind to settle, so we want that result. We want to feel peaceful and content and happy, and we want the mind to settle. And so the tendency when we first come to meditation is to, whether it's sitting or walking meditation, is to try and try as hard as we can to stop thinking, stop proliferating about things, try as hard as we can to quote-unquote let go. And then we quickly find that it doesn't work that way. So we try really hard to stop thinking or try really hard to meditate, and some people might have a natural proclivity toward samadhi and the mind might settle quickly, but for most of us, we find that doesn't work, the trying to force the mind to stop thinking. And if we look at the suttas, the Buddha doesn't recommend that. The Buddha has the gradual training, so he's recommending this integrated approach toward practice. And yes, in second jhana, apparently the thinking does stop. The what we call the verbal formation does end up stopping. But the path to getting there isn't to try to make oneself stop thinking. So it's this integrated and gradual approach to practice. And so you really get that in the Thai forest tradition, where they are recommending meditating and practicing a lot, doing a lot of walking meditation, a lot of sitting meditation. And there's this gradual approach, though, to the practice, to the settling that actually happens in the mind. So it goes something like, one hears the teachings, develops faith in the teachings, wants to seek out teachers, hear the true Dhamma. And in Majjhima Nikaya 39, the Maha Asapura Sutta, then it talks about specifically the path of ordination, where then one decides to ordain, undertake the Padimokkha Sila, the Padimokkha restraint, and undertakes that training, tries to purify it, make it good, make it perfect, tries to follow the precepts as closely as possible. And when that's in place, then one looks at how one is relating to food, not for fun, not for pleasure, not for fattening, not for beautification, only for the maintenance and nourishment of this body, So developing a sense of equanimity toward food, toward physical nutriment that keeps us alive. And then there's the Chagarya Nu Yoga, the commitment to wakefulness after that. So seeing how much sleep one actually needs, and paring back the amount we sleep a bit, and testing and seeing what's the right amount. Can we go with less sleep than we think we need? And it's not no sleep, so it's not no food, it's not no sleep. That's the Atakilamata Nu Yoga. That's the self-torment, self-torture. But we're looking for balance, but the balance of the middle way is a little bit more austere than what we would normally think of as our comfort zone. So it is outside of, tends to be, the middle way that the Buddha's talking about does tend to be outside of our comfort zone. So we're pushing the edges of our comfort zone with food and sleep. Slightly more austere, but not, doesn't have to be over the top, it doesn't have to be heroic austerity, but it's just slightly more austere than what we're used to. And then the Buddha goes into mindfulness. And some of these I might be getting the order wrong, but the clear comprehension, the sati sampajanya, the mindfulness and clear comprehension. Moving forward and back, one is clearly aware of what one is doing. Eating and drinking, one is clearly aware of what one is doing. Even using the toilet facilities, one is clearly aware of what one is doing. When they're speaking or keeping silent, one is clearly aware and mindful of what they're doing. Standing, walking, sitting, lying down, stretching and extending one's limbs. So in every activity of the day, one is mindful and clearly aware of what one is doing. So you can think of that as just being present, being there. And then the Buddha goes into sense restraint. And the sense restraint, you could summarize it by saying that it's trying to not give rise to like and dislike by way of the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind. So it's, you could also summarize it as staying in rather than going out. So rather than sending the attention out the eye to forms, or out the ear to sounds, or out the nose to odors, or out the tongue to tastes, out the body to tangible sensations, out the mind to brilliant and good ideas, but then staying in and learning how to just watch that process. So that's the sense restraint. And then from the sense restraint, it goes into the jhanas. That's through the relinquishment of the five hindrances. So then the sense restraint, and then looking at what are these different hindrances in the mind. There's the kamachanda, the sensual desire or the drive toward sensuality. It's the vyapada, the ill will, tinamida, sloth and torpor, uducha kukucha, which is could be very onomatopoeic. That's the restlessness and anxiety, restlessness and worry. Then there's vichikicca, which is doubt. And in terms of meditation instruction, somebody like Lompo Cha, I think taking more of that standard of looking at those five hindrances. And yet nowhere in there is the instruction to try as hard as you can to stop thinking. That's interesting. He does say in Sati Sampajanya, the Buddha does teach about being present. So there's that sense of non-distraction or not following the distracted thoughts or going out from ourselves. So there's that sense of embodied presence that we have with the Sati Sampajanya, and that there's that sense of embodiment that gets even stronger in the sense restraint. And in terms of the five hindrances, then it's the Buddha using analogies of water, that when there's sensual desire in the mind, it's like water that has dye in it. So you can kind of see through it, but it's colored that you can't see accurately. With ill will, it's like water that's boiling. Can't see clearly through it. It's hot. It's stirred up. The sloth and torpor, it's like water with like pond weeds, pond scum. And it's murky. With the restlessness, it's like water with ripples and waves on it. It's like wind on water. Can't see down through it, can't see clearly. With doubt, doubt is a dual analogy. So with doubt, then it's like muddy water in the dark. So you just, it's thick, turbid, you can't really, can't see the water so much as, or even, needless to speak of, see through the water. So all these things, the Buddha says, it hinders wisdom, hinders seeing clearly. So that hints that what we're looking at through the practice is clear seeing, clear knowing of the way things are. And then, of course, when those five hindrances are abandoned, it's like a still pool. And when there's the still pool, then through that still pool, the Four Noble Truths can start to become clear. When the pool is still, you can look down and see fish swimming about. You can see even the rocks and the pebbles in the bottom of the pool. When it's still, clear water, you can't see those things when it's stirred up. So there's various practices for this, for the relinquishment of sensuality, sensual drive, kama chanda, then it's the asubha kamatana, the directing the mind toward that which is unbeautiful rather than that which is beautiful, so changing the way we're directing our mind. So the mind is always being directed somehow, and depending on how strong the mental obscurations, the defilements are, it's going to be directed either toward unwholesome or wholesome objects. And in this case, if we direct our mind towards objects that cause an increase in kamachanda, an increase in sensual desire, then we need to, through the practice, then we actually have to put effort into directing the mind in a different way toward the asubha, toward objects that are unbeautiful, in order to allow that dye to settle and cool the mind down. And so an increase in kamachanda can come about through there's another vocabulary word, ayoniso manisikara, which is unwise attention. It's the opposite of yoniso manisikara, wise attention. So because of unwise attention to the sign of the beautiful, then sensual desire increases, and that's its nutriment. So we need to use yoniso manisikara, put some wise attention, skillful attention on the sign of the unattractive, the sign of the unbeautiful, then that sensual desire can become less. Then the next hindrance is kind of the opposite. It's the boiling water, the ill will. We could think of it as frustration, irritation, ill will, different grades, different levels, ranging from mild irritation to murderous rage, everything in between. And the Buddha said that gets stronger, that is nourished by unwise attention to the unbeautiful. So it's the opposite of the previous one. So unwise attention to the unbeautiful, or the sign of the unbeautiful, the sign of frustration, the sign of irritation, the sign of whatever's making us, whatever's causing that water to boil, whatever's causing the mind to boil. So then the wise attention in that instance would be wise attention to the sign of the beautiful, which is goodwill, metta. That's what we call the metta kamatana. So the wise attention to the sign of the beautiful. So it's interesting to note that there's wise and unwise attention to the sign of the beautiful, and there's wise and unwise attention to the sign of the unbeautiful. And it just depends on what we need to work with. And the wise attention to the sign of the beautiful doesn't have to be metta in the form of may I be well, may I be happy, and so on. But it can be, say, for example, if we're frustrated or irritated with somebody and we can't let go of either something they said or did or some quality they have that we don't like, then that's unwise attention to the sign of the unbeautiful. So then what we can do is try to see, do they have any good qualities? Have they ever helped me out? Have they ever been kind to me? So in that sense, you're giving wise attention to the sign of the beautiful, those beautiful qualities in the other person. So that's a way we can apply that practice. Sloth and torpor, the Buddha talks about giving rise to a perception of light in the mind, to try to wake oneself up, brighten the mind. There's also the recommendation to do walking meditation if there's a lot of drowsiness, a lot of sloth and torpor. Somehow the order of the hindrances seems to have some significance as well. I know when I've done longer retreats, those hindrances do seem to come up somehow in that order. And sloth and torpor is an interesting one, because I remember when I was in Anagarika, a novice, and we actually had some Siladharas living here. And I remember talking about meditation one day with Sister Jitindriya, and she mentioned that sloth and torpor and ill will are very interconnected, that if there's a lot of ill will, then there'll be a lot of sloth and torpor. And as the ill will becomes less, the sloth and torpor does seem to become less. And I kind of questioned that and thought, hey, I can be angry and just force myself to stay awake. But sure enough, had a lot of problems with sloth and torpor early on. And as the anger became less over the years, I did see that the sloth and torpor was generally proportional to the amount of anger or ill will that I had as a hindrance. And I just found that very interesting. She was definitely right about that. And I've heard other people say that now over the years, that, and now I can attest to that, that yes, as that second hindrance becomes less for myself, sloth and torpor definitely became less, and my body can be quite tired, and but I can still, the mind can still feel awake during meditation, and that certainly wasn't the case before. And there's the restlessness and worry that this is somewhat connected with sila, so it's difficult for the mind to settle when, say, we've taken the precepts and we end up breaking a precept. It's difficult for the mind to settle until we tell somebody about that or rectify the situation. The mind is going to be thinking about it, proliferating about it. So in terms of the mind not being restless or the mind settling, then a purification of sila or focus on sila is important. But then there's the subtle restlessness, the very subtle agitation of the mind. That doesn't disappear until arhantship, according to the suttas. It's one of the last fetters to go. So it's okay if you're restless. You can rest assured that that it's a difficult one to overcome. It's only at the very, very end of the practice that that one would be overcome. But as a hindrance, we can temporarily overcome it. We can temporarily be liberated from it through that focus on sila. And also anapanasati, putting the attention on the breath. Then the doubt. And doubt is an interesting one because when there's an issue or a problem that we have or that we need to solve, or there's we're not sure about what to do next, either in the meditation or in our life in general. So it might be like a life doubt, like what do I do next in my life? Do I join the monastery, or do I take on a career, or do I go to school, or do I get another degree, or whatever? Or should I join the military? Or should I become a YouTuber, or whatever? We might have this doubt in our mind, what's the best thing to do? So that doubt, we try to think our way to the end of that doubt, and that tends to increase it. That tends to feed it. It's very interesting, I think, that this doubt is one of the fetters that disappears at stream entry. And it's actually taught in a couple different ways, where one angle is it's doubt in Buddha Dhamma Sangha. So time of stream entry, of course, okay, well, the teachings are true. What the Buddha taught is true. Okay, no more doubt in Buddha Dhamma Sangha. But then there's another angle to that doubt is one no longer has doubt about what's wholesome and unwholesome. One no longer has doubt about what's skillful and unskillful. And that's very interesting to me, that kind of doubt falls away. So even though it's said that a stream enterer can really mess up, can really do things, make mistakes, can still have failures, still make mistakes, but they catch themselves really quickly, and there's no doubt that they made a mistake, there's no doubt that they did something wrong, there's no doubt that what they just did was unwholesome, and so then there's that desire to reveal it, make it known, be very transparent in one's actions. And then when something good is done, when a wholesome action is done, there's no doubt that it was good, and then one has that sense of delight in that good action. So how does that doubt pass away? That has to be through seeing clearly, through considering, looking into. So we're not going to think our way to the end of doubt. the thinking is going to wear us out. So we learn about the different aspects of these, the way we're using our mind. So I have so much doubt. How should I do this? Should I do that? So that thinking wears us out. So we do kind of a quantum shift here in our viewpoint and say, okay, well, I have no doubt that thinking my way to the end of doubt wears me out. So I have no doubt about that. So I can be sure about that. So then what can we be sure about? And then we can try to take it from that angle rather than trying to address the doubt directly. We can sidestep it in a sense. Yeah. So what's the process of doubt? What's the mind do with doubt? What's it like if I just sit here and there's no doubt, but there can be this kind of sense of urgency of, I got to figure it out. Got to figure out what to do next. Then when we can't figure it out, we might want to ask someone, we might want to ask a teacher, what do I do next? What should I do? What should I do in my life next? What's going to be the best? Of course, only you can know that for yourself. The other thing I was coming up for me today was just the sheer number of people who have come and gone here. Starting to make plans for this 25th anniversary of Abhayagiri, and just so how many great Krupa Ajahns and great monks have passed through, and how many guests have come here and passed through, and how many people have just been here and practiced here, and how we've all been practicing together for such a long time, and it's pretty amazing how many people have been to this monastery at this point. Thinking Longpor Liam, is thinking of all the times he's been here, and I think he's actually been here 5 times. So 1999, and I wasn't here yet at that time. But then there's 2004. Remember, my dad helped drive on a trip, 1 week road trip with Longpor Liam, you know, Ajahn Jundi, Ajahn Yanadamo, Ajahn Uttane. We went on this memorable road trip, ending at Birkin. And then we ended up driving back. And I think Longpor Liam and Ajahn Jundi stayed on at Birkin at that time. And Tina was on that trip. She was here today. So then Longpor Liam and Longpor Anek were here in 2009. And Longpor Liam was here again in 2015 with Ajahn Sekh. So that was the first time Ajahn Sekh came here to see if it was a suitable place to come and live and practice, train, be a resident Thai monk. And then 2018 was the last time Longpor Liam visited, and that was the grand opening of this hall, where we shifted and changed from what's now the dining hall, used to be the Dhamma hall. So that was where we were doing all of our pujas, meditations, Saturday night talks, Lunar Observance Day talks, all-night sits. We're doing it all in there, and there's so much memory connected at that place. But now there's kind of a phenomenon I'm experiencing where it's so much has happened, and it's been long enough that it's more like this present moment awareness. And it's like, oh yeah, there was a house there until 2016, and then it got torn down. And so there's sometimes it's easy to forget everything that's happened, but it can give rise to a sense of a sense of joy, a sense of wonder at what we've been able to create here. So don't have so much to say this evening. That's just a few thoughts bopping around in the mind. I'll leave it there.